Hi there, I'm Marco Werman. Every day our program has hundreds of thousands of listeners from all around the globe. If everyone who listened to The World donated during our drive, we'd be set for a while. That's just not possible for everyone. Times are tough. But if you are in a position to give, and if our show has touched you, if it's helped you feel more connected or perhaps more optimistic about the world around you, then please donate today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you very much. And now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world. Support comes from Redefiners, a new podcast from Russell Reynolds Associates. If you want to lead boldly, then Redefiners, a new podcast, is a must-listen. Join hosts Nanez Motashami and Clark Murphy as they engage in purposeful conversations with leaders in and out of business, each sharing their insights and perspectives with you. Every episode gives you tangible takeaways and fresh ideas to help you redefine your own leadership trajectory, no matter where you are in your journey. Listen to Redefiners wherever you get your podcasts.
Climate change has led to alarming damage and loss around the globe.
We haven't been able to avoid it. We haven't been able to prevent it. We haven't been able to prepare for it. It's happening.
So who's going to pay to fix it? A challenging question facing negotiators at the UN Climate Summit. I'm Marco Werman. Also today, we hear from the mayor-elect of Dearborn, Michigan.
I never ran to be the first Arab or Muslim. I ran to be the best.
Still, he's the first Arab-Muslim leader of a very Arab-Muslim city. And a school in Vermont is helping immigrant kids succeed by letting them use their native languages in class.
This is what you need to, in order for your kids to be successful in the school district.
And the difficult choices people fleeing Afghanistan had to make about what to take and what to leave behind. All those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad you could be with us. China and the U.S. stepped out together today in Glasgow, Scotland. The two countries are at odds in so many ways. But at the U.N. Climate Conference today, the U.S. and China jointly pledged to increase their cooperation on climate change. Back-to-back press conferences by climate envoy John Kerry and his Chinese counterpart Xie Jinhua were meant to show that the world's biggest two polluters are working together on climate change. Cooperation is one thing, but money, that's a different story. Turns out that one of the most contentious issues being discussed at the United Nations Climate Summit is about financing. Money developing countries need to adapt to rising seas, worsening floods, and devastating droughts brought on by climate change, and to make the switch to renewable energy. But there's another kind of funding that's even more controversial and getting more attention than ever before. From Glasgow, the world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports.
Last week, thousands of negotiators were here, rushing around the sprawling conference center in Glasgow, talking about climate change. Guyot Ibrahi was 6,000 miles away, living it. Ibrahi is a herder in northern Africa, where a drought is killing off livestock and pushing millions toward hunger. He says, we do not have water. We also do not have grass or pasture. Ibrahi sits by a borehole driven deep into the ground to make watering holes in an area where natural ones have dried up. Herders travel from far away to water their goats, donkeys, and camels with ribs sticking out. The seasonal rains here are less reliable than in the past, and drought is expected to grow worse as the climate warms more. Ibrahi says no one has gotten through this dry spell without losing an animal. He says the livestock are his livelihood, so the drought impacts his family, his wife, and kids. When the livestock are there, he says, we have food. Without them, we don't have anything to eat and no milk to drink, he says. It's scary. At the climate summit here in Glasgow, developing countries are asking for financial help for people like Ibrahim, those already enduring what the UN calls losses and damages.
These impacts aren't going to happen in the future. They're already happening right now.
This is Salimul Haq, a veteran of those talks, who serves as an advisor to two coalitions of vulnerable nations.
That's loss and damage. We haven't been able to avoid it. We haven't been able to prevent it. We haven't been able to prepare for it. It's happening, and so we need to address it. And that's what the demand from the vulnerable countries in particular here in COP is. We need to address loss and damage.
Damages here mean things that can be replaced, like Ibrahim's livestock. Losses are gone forever. Human lives, land on island nations swallowed by the sea.
Tuvalu and other low-lying atoll nations are sinking.
The Prime Minister of Tuvalu, Kausai Natano, spoke at the beginning of the climate summit.
Whatever our progress in combating climate change, there will likely be countries who cannot adapt, and we will see significant loss and damage.
Given this truth, he says, Tuvalu needs money. Leaders and negotiators at these summits have been talking about research and technical knowledge sharing around loss and damage for years, but compensation has been a non-starter. Developed countries, especially the U.S., have worried that providing payments for damages from climate change would open the door to claims of legal liability. Here's the U.S. climate envoy Todd Stern in Paris in 2015 when asked about loss and damage in a press conference.
We have made it clear that we are supportive of the concept. Broadly speaking, we've also made it clear that we are not at all supportive of and would not accept the notion of liability and compensation being part of that.
Liability and compensation has really become dirty words in this space.
Professor Lisa Van Hella studies the politics of loss and damage at University College London.
They're a bit taboo, and you don't often hear them uttered in the negotiations themselves.
Developing countries say legal claims are not what they are looking for. But there are other tricky issues, Van Hella says.
How do you even start to think about compensating when an island disappears? How do you make that right? What does restitution look like?
For damages alone, estimates of annual costs by 2030 tally in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
I think that's where the nervousness comes from. It's so broad and it's so big.
But a lot has changed in the 6 years since the Paris Agreement was signed. The science linking climate change to worsening extreme weather events has become unequivocal. Scientists can now say a particular hurricane dumped more rain, for example, because of climate change. Scientist Sarah Kew says she and colleagues at the World Weather Attribution Initiative were able to draw an even stronger conclusion for recent heat waves in the Pacific Northwest and Siberia.
When you look back at the past climate, you would never get events of that extremity. And so you can say then with very, very high certainty that that specific event happened because of climate change. And that's something that we haven't been able to do before.
At this summit, observers say the improved science has changed the conversation about losses and damages, both inside the negotiating rooms and in public. Like when President Joe Biden called on countries that have done the most to cause climate change to do more for those who have done the least.
We have to help much more than we have thus far.
Financing for loss and damage was not on the official agenda coming into this summit. But behind the closed doors of the meeting room I'm outside right now in Glasgow, developing countries are insisting it be discussed. They're asking for a couple of things. One is a specific category of funding for loss and damage to be included in a new climate finance goal. Another is the ability to report their loss and damage needs through an existing climate fund. Salimul Haq doesn't see money for loss and damage flowing through the UN system because decisions at these climate summits require consensus.
That's inside the negotiations. But outside the negotiations, outside the blue zone where we are sitting right now, in the city of Glasgow, in the country of Scotland, stuff is happening.
Scotland last week pledged £1 million, about $1.4 million, in the first fund earmarked for loss and damage. Haq hopes it's the beginning of a coalition of the willing, banding together outside the UN framework. In a recent speech, Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, says it's about justice.
For a very, very long time, we have enjoyed all of the material benefits of the carbon emissions that are causing climate change. And like so many other developed nations, we have benefited much more than those countries that are now facing and experiencing the worst impacts of the climate crisis.
Sturgeon called on leaders at the summit to address losses and damages caused by droughts, floods, loss of life, and population displacement.
But it can't simply be discussed. We must see progress. I know this is something I'll be following closely during the summit.
Salim Yolhuq will be too.
To my mind, the climate change problem now is an ethical problem. And I call it the biggest injustice in the world. Rich people cause the problem. And poor people around the world are suffering the consequences. That's just morally wrong, and we should do something about it.
This issue is one of the most contentious at the summit. With just 2 days until it's scheduled to end, talks are stretching late into the night. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland.
Mask up. You may not like it, but it works, and is respectful of the health and safety of those around you. There is a downside, though, in relying on all this personal protective equipment.
It's made from plastic, and plastic is made to not fall apart.
Auke Florian Eemstra is a biologist at the Naturalis Biodiversity Center in the Netherlands. He helps run the COVID Litter Project. It tracks instances of wildlife being hurt by discarded PPE.
We have observations from Namibia, from Germany, from America, from Ireland, from India, from the Philippines, from Canada. All around the world, these interactions with COVID litter are happening, sadly.
A new study from researchers in China found that the pandemic has generated around 8 million tons of plastic waste. And much of that stuff ended up in the world's oceans.
It's ironic that the material that protects us is actually harming the animals around us.
Wildlife can choke on disposable masks and gloves or get trapped by them, says Lisa-Lota Rambonet from the COVID Litter Project.
And not only wild animals, but also domestic animals, so cats and dogs, are also ingesting face masks.
The solution, she says, get a mask you like and hold on to it. The U.S. opened its borders this week to visitors from many countries around the world, including Canada next door. Americans have been allowed to travel north of the border for nearly 3 months now. There's one requirement, though, that's still keeping many Americans from going north, and it's hurting the tourism industry and border towns. From Niagara Falls, Ontario, Anita Elash reports.
Phil Pasco runs one of the oldest pubs in the heart of Niagara Falls' main tourist district.
On Saturdays and Sundays, I'll have a dozen people at my door at 11 a.m.
Until the pandemic started, most of his customers drove across the border from the United States.
We used to have regulars, like regulars from Ohio, Pennsylvania, New York, that would come on a certain, you know, that weekend, like if the Patriots are in Buffalo. I'd have the bar, you couldn't get in here. That's a huge crowd.
Pasco says his restaurant was still busy this summer with Canadian visitors, but his American customers haven't come back, and that's making a big dent in his bottom line.
Americans like to drink, Americans like to eat, they like to spend money, they like to have a good time. If they're on vacation, there's no holds barred. And that disappeared.
Do you hunger for real life adventure? Then come inside.
A plaster pharaoh, in conversation with a talking cobra, invites visitors in to have a look around a wax museum. The tourism district in Niagara Falls is starting to come back to life. Earlier this week, a few families and young couples stopped to take selfies on Clifton Hill.
With your favorite stars in the scenes that made them famous.
Before COVID, about a third of tourists were from the United States and would stay several days. Janice Thompson, who runs the tourism office, blames the lack of Americans this season in part on Canadian caution. To cross the border, the Canadian government still requires unvaccinated children under 12 to quarantine for 2 weeks, and even vaccinated children and adults have to show a negative PCR COVID test. That can cost up to $200 a person.
Well, it's generally a large family market that comes here from the United States. We see a lot of families. And clearly the requirements to quarantine or to get tested, those are weighing heavily on families. There's a cost attached to them.
Thompson says hotels have been hit especially hard. She won't give numbers, but says bookings are still way down. A quick walk around town, and you'll also find many hotels in the tourist core are temporarily closed. To lure more people back, Thompson says the tourist office is planning an extended light and music festival this winter.
It's just one long ribbon of lights all the way along the parkway and through Dufferin Islands. And it's magical, frankly, to see.
Raj Agarwal says that magic will only help businesses like his if the festival attracts more Americans.
Our business is really bad. So we really need Americans to come over here so they can spend good time here and we can have some sale.
Agarwal runs 4 souvenir shops in the area. He specializes in maple syrup, T-shirts, hats and tchotchkes that remind people they've been to Canada. Not the kind of thing many Canadians are interested in.
Our Niagara Falls business, 80% is depend on American tourists. And they couldn't come. So last year we had only like 10-20% sale of our business. So we like lost lot.
He says he survived this summer by stocking more generic items such as plain T-shirts and swimsuits, things that Canadian visitors needed. But he's already laid off more staff than usual for the winter. For The World, I'm Anita Elash, Niagara Falls, Ontario.
And you're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Meta was taken to task last month in Congress for not doing enough to tamp down the spread of misinformation. But the problems are far from only in the U.S. For The Global View, we turn to Imran Ahmed. He's the CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate and joins us from Washington. Let's get a little techie, Imran, but not too techie. How do Facebook's algorithms work? Why is it pumping out extreme hateful content to millions of users?
Facebook's algorithm, in one sense, is really simple. It is a reflection of its business model, which is that it tries to drive attention to its platform by promoting the most sticky content in order to have eyeballs that it can drive ads to, because that's how it makes money. I mean, Facebook's revenues, 98% of them come from advertising that it serves up to people as they're surfing the rest of Facebook. And what they've discovered is that the stickiest content is conspiracist content. It's content that gets us emotional, angry, so hate, misinformation. Misinformation's power is that not only do people who agree with it, but also people who disagree with it love to engage with it.
So what does it tell us about Meta that they continue to run on this business model?
Well, it tells us that their business model is fundamentally flawed and that there are no consequences for the malignancies, for the problems that they create. You know, most industries, if you create harm, then there are means of restitution. If you're a deli and you poison people, there's both individual restitution, but also the state can take action. You know, the government can take action against you as well and say, well, we're closing you down on health and safety grounds. It is remarkable that the health and safety regime for a deli or bodega is more intrusive and more consequential and has more tools available for action than for a platform that, by its own admission, has led to at least one genocide of the Rohingya.
Yeah, explain that. I was going to ask you, if we look globally, what's happening?
Around the world, the impact of Facebook is very similar to the impact in the US in that it's increased division in societies. It's promoted hate and misinformation, which then has a knock-on impact in terms of lives lost. And one of the things that Francis Haugen, the whistleblower from Facebook, revealed is that they knew that it was changing the fundamental nature of politics globally as well. So in Poland, you know, fringe parties were coming to great prominence, and they were saying the reason for that is because they had been given the boost by the Facebook algorithm itself.
So your organization, Imran, the Center for Countering Digital Hate, has released a new report called The Toxic 10. What are The Toxic 10 and what did you find?
We studied the spread of disinformation about the climate, which is the biggest threat to the future of our species, is climate change. And so we thought it was important for us to understand, well, how is disinformation spreading about them? And we looked at what evidence points are being shared. So when people make big claims, they don't tend to say, I think X. They tend to say, look at this, which says X. So we looked at what links are being shared. Mm. And we found that 10 websites, which are algorithmically optimized producers of misinformation, they understand how to game the algorithm. So they are the ones who are most shared and therefore most seen. driving traffic to their websites and allowing them to garner ad revenue, we found that 10 websites comprised 69% of all the shares of misinformation about climate change in our study.
So what kind of sticky things were being stated about climate?
Look, it's really smart the way that they do it. They tell you that you're being lied to by everyone else. They tell you that they've got special information that no one else has. And if you then consume their information, they can unravel the truth for you. And of course, you never stop unraveling the truth because there is no truth behind it. But while you are going through that web of content, you're consuming ads, and that's all they really care about. Because the other thing we found was not only are they algorithmically optimized to work on Facebook, but Google is placing the ads on their website. So they're all part of Google's biggest business is actually their advertising business. And what they do is they sit as a broker in between content websites and brands, and they funnel those brands' adverts onto content websites. Those websites include some of the toxic 10 websites that we found produce 69% of misinformation about climate change.
So given how clever these toxic 10 are, and that's just one cohort of misinformation traffickers, how do we get things to change online?
Look, at a really simple level, the exposure work that organizations like CCDH do, they provide the driver for both internal change. So for those organizations to look at themselves, and, you know, Joe Biden said it to Facebook a few months ago when he used one of our studies to call Facebook killers. He said, think of your family, think of them consuming that misinformation and putting themselves in harm's way. Is that worth it? And we ask people to think about the moral consequences of what they do. What we are discovering is just the scale of disinformation out there, the way in which it's organized, that it could be dealt with quite easily if people were more responsible with who they allowed to use the megaphone of social media and their platform's algorithmic amplification and did the right thing.
Remind us how Facebook has responded to these allegations that its algorithm is spreading hate and misinformation. And do you buy their explanation?
Put out a survey in early 2021, the Disinformation Dozen, which showed how 12 bad actors, people like Joseph Mercola, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., are behind 65% of all misinformation about COVID vaccines. And that was a very successful report. It had a real impact with Congress, with the president, with attorneys general around the country and the media. And Facebook, a few months later, put out a rebuttal saying that we were essentially wrong and that a small number of people didn't create a disproportionate amount of harm, essentially calling us liars and claiming that we'd made mistakes with our research. It then turned out, of course, in the Frances Haugen revelations, that they themselves had a report come out on the very same day our report came out. They had an internal report with the exact same findings. And it just goes to show you that we're not dealing with companies that don't realize the scale of the harm or the nature of the harm or how the harm's being produced. They themselves know. They themselves have internal research to prove that we're right.
So, Imran, you began by telling us that Facebook's spread of misinformation is really a function of its algorithm, and that's how it makes money. Ultimately, do you believe Facebook wants to change?
I think if Facebook wanted to change, they would have. But, you know, I tend to give companies the benefit of the doubt that they are essentially amoral. They're not moral entities, and they will fill the gaps left by any regulatory framework. Now, in the United States, the regulatory framework for internet companies like Facebook was set in 1996, before social media even existed, by the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, and it hasn't been updated since. The irony is, Facebook themselves are putting full-page ads in newspapers saying it's time for us to review the regulatory framework. I think we should do that.
So Facebook is undergoing a rebrand right now. Will that have any sort of impact on the algorithm? I mean, is it a sign that they are ready, maybe, to change?
I mean, they are now calling themselves Meta, but to coin a phrase, they could be doing a lot better in every aspect of how they do business.
Imran Ahmed is a founding CEO of the Center for Countering Digital Hate. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
More stories from around the globe still ahead. You're listening to The World. The Taliban takeover in Afghanistan happened so fast, it took a lot of people by surprise, like this Afghan woman.
Never have I ever imagined, even in my right mind, that this could happen so quickly and in the way it did.
She decided to leave knowing the extremist Taliban, but then came the question, what was she going to take with her? That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For decades, Dearborn, Michigan has attracted immigrants from the Middle East. Lebanese, Iraqis, Syrians, and Yemenis have all settled there. The city's large Arab-American population has made it a center for Arabic language, food, and culture. But Dearborn has never had a mayor of Arab background. That changed last week when the city elected State Representative Abdullah Hamoud as its new leader. He joins us now. Mayor-elect Hamoud, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
So Dearborn has one of the largest Muslim populations in the U.S. Immigrants from the Arab world have been settling there for a long time, as I said. In 2021, that changes with you at the center of the story. I mean, why'd it take so long?
Dearborn is known for having longstanding mayors, and the last open mayor's election was actually some 35 years ago. And this time around, you know, we ran a campaign when that opportunity presented itself that focused on the issues impacting working families in all four corners of the city.
Talk a bit about those conversations you were having during the campaign. I mean, what were you hearing from people?
One of the biggest concerns for residents was the flooding. You know, this summer, we had a catastrophic flooding event that led to about 20,000 homes experiencing flooding to a level of severity. And so it was top of people's minds that they were wondering, when the next heavy rain sets in, am I going to have to put my livelihood at the curbside and wait for a dump truck to pick it up? And so that's one of the most pressing concerns.
So we're talking basic municipal concerns here. As a mayor of Arab background, Islamophobia and racism also have to be front and center for you, I'm guessing. How significant do you think it is for the city of Dearborn and its Arab population to have an Arab Muslim as their incoming mayor?
I think it demonstrates that representation matters, one. But I think secondly, and most importantly, in the city of Dearborn, I never ran to be the first Arab or Muslim. I ran to be the best. And what we demonstrate here in Dearborn, in my hometown, is that people are willing to elect an individual based on the direction in which they lead, no matter the direction in which they pray. And that a name like Abdullah Hussein Hamoud is as American as any other. And you need not change it. You need not change who you are or shy away from your faith, ethnicity, that you can still run for public office and try to give back to the community that gave you everything.
So, Mayor-elect Hamoud, you're one of three first Arab-American Muslim mayors-elect in the Detroit metro area. What is the takeaway here?
You're seeing minority populations and residents begin to really get involved in the political process. We saw a surge in the voter turnout amongst the Arab-American residents, amongst Muslim-American residents in the city of Dearborn. We saw a dramatic increase in turnout amongst youth. And I think if you run a successful campaign that localizes the issues, if you have a strong ground game, you're going to lead a successful campaign. And these three candidates just happened to be minorities while they did that.
So, Mayor-elect Hamoud, you'll be at City Hall in Dearborn, but with such a large Arab immigrant community, you're also in a position to weigh in on foreign affairs, especially with regard to U.S. policy in the Middle East. Do you see a role for yourself in that regard?
Maybe others would want to impose that role onto me. I'm a Dearbornite at heart, and my focus is going to be on the issues impacting residents.
But surely as someone with an Arab background, you at least have the capacity to kind of reach out to those people who have come from the Middle East.
Oh, of course. I mean, we actually want to launch a community relations department that works with meeting people where they are to ensure that we're providing them, you know, whatever it might be, to assist them in their day-to-day endeavors.
So what is your biggest hope once you get into City Hall?
That we're actually able to enact several of these policies, you know, that we put out along the campaign trail, that we actually improve the quality of life and we're able to measure it on what we have done differently, and that when we walk away from that office, we left it better than we first received it.
Michigan State Representative Abdullah Hamoud is the newly elected mayor of Dearborn, Michigan. Thank you very much, Mayor-elect, and best of luck to you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Tens of thousands of Afghans who left their country after the Taliban took over in August will be resettling in the United States. Many of them are kids, so schools across the country are preparing to get these students up to speed. Administrators at one school in Vermont feel they're ready. For years, this school has used an innovative scheme to help refugee and immigrant kids succeed. The New England News Collaborative's Ben James takes us to Burlington, Vermont, where teachers are embracing the first languages of immigrant families in their lesson plans.
In an office in Burlington High School in northern Vermont, Chacha Munga calls a student's father, speaking in their shared language, Swahili.
Hello?
Jambo, jambo.
Munga is a multilingual liaison, one of 12 employed by the Burlington District. A few feet away, Noor Bole, another liaison, makes a call in Maimai to the Somali Bantu mother of several kids in the district. Vermont is overwhelmingly white and English-speaking, but Burlington stands out for its ethnic diversity. In the hallways at Burlington High, you'll hear kids speaking Nepali, Bosnian, Somali, Vietnamese. Nearly one in five Burlington students are classified as English language learners, meaning they're still building their English fluency. Bole says the multilingual liaisons help refugee families understand how the U.S. school system works.
This is like a big opportunity for them to educate their own kids. All the sacrifice they made is for their own child. So that's why we are like, you know, this is what you need to, in order for your kids to be successful in the school district.
The multilingual liaisons are just one part of Burlington's recent efforts to adopt what district officials call a multilingual mindset. Some refugee students say it's helped them get to college. Bibek Garoon is a junior at Champlain College in Burlington, studying criminal justice. He says his Nepali-speaking liaison helped him with high school and with what he calls life stuff.
I was actually looking for a job, and he advocated for me. And through him, I was able to work for the Burlington Police Department as a beach and park patrol officer. So he played a huge part on that.
Shauna Shapiro, an associate professor at Middlebury College in Vermont, says many refugee students in the U.S. finish high school unprepared for college. Part of the problem, she says, lies with English language learning programs that place students in lower-level academic classes, leaving them bored and under-challenged.
And they say, that's frustrating because my parents were leaders in the refugee camp, and my mom was a professor, and my uncle was a police officer, and we're here, and it feels like no one recognizes any of that.
Samjana Rai, a college-bound senior who arrived from Nepal when she was in seventh grade, has heard a similar frustration.
A lot of my friends, they want to go to college, right? But like, because of classes that they had to take their sophomore year, freshman year, it's like a little harder for them to go to college that they want to go to.
Rai has prepared as much as she can for college, taking advanced placement and college-level classes. She doesn't see many refugee students there, though, and she'd like that to change. Down the hallway from the multilingual liaison office, a ninth-grade English class is working on plot diagrams.
You're creating a pyramid of a story plotline pyramid, a fry tags pyramid.
The class is a mix of native English speakers and English learners. It's taught by two teachers, the regular subject teacher and Susan Blethen, a specialist in English language learning.
I don't think a lot of the kids know I'm a language specialist.
Okay.
They just know me as Ms. Blethen.
She says one purpose of the mixed classes is to make sure the English learners are being taught material that's stimulating, that inspires them to take on more challenges. In previous years, Blethen says, many of the English learners in this class would have been placed in what's called sheltered instruction, separated from their native English-speaking peers.
I actually had a social studies teacher yell at me when I was a very young teacher saying, why are they in my class if they can't speak English? You have to teach them English before they can come into my class.
Times have changed, at least in Burlington. But how much? I asked some ninth graders whether the multilingual liaisons and the mixed classes were making a difference for their lives as students. A few girls shook their heads. They said their languages and cultures are still undervalued at school, and their classes are often too easy.
Bilingual people aren't dumb, and they can be challenged, and they can be doing higher things.
That's Isra Adden, a multilingual Somali-speaking student who plans to take honors civics next semester.
I thought, maybe I can just challenge myself instead of, you know, doing an easy class. I should just challenge myself because I'd be learning more if I did.
Watching from nearby, Miss Blethen nods her head in approval. For The World, I'm Ben James in Burlington, Vermont.
The Kyiv Post calls itself Ukraine's global voice since 1995. But as of Monday, the English language newspaper is voiceless. Its owner, businessman Adnan Kivan, shut down the paper and let the staff go. In a statement, he said the closure is temporary for, quote, a short time. But the newspaper staff says the move is an act of vengeance. Igor Kosov joins us from Kyiv. He was, up until a few days ago, the news editor at the Kyiv Post. You and the staff of the Kyiv Post issued your own statement on Facebook, Igor. You say the owner shut down the Kyiv Post to infringe on our editorial independence. Explain what you mean.
Well, for several weeks before this closure, Mr. Kivan came to us with a plan. He communicated that he wants to add several new sections, greatly scale up the Kyiv Post, but he would appoint one of his own people to lead the new Ukrainian section. And this person has never worked in independent media before. In fact, she's working for his mouthpiece, which is a channel in Odessa. And we took a stand against this, and also some of the ideas seemed less than practical. So we tried to meet with him halfway and figure out how to get it done in a workable fashion. And while we were getting this off the ground, all of a sudden, he just decided to pull the plug. And it seemed to us that either decided that he's done with us and he wants to close us and then pick up more compliant staff and sort of make a Kyiv Post more tame and less independent, or it could have been vengeance, like we said.
Is that what Kivan has said? I mean, or is that your concern that he will reopen but not rehire you and the rest of the staff?
Mr. Kivan literally did say that this is a reboot and that he will open the Kyiv Post bigger and better. Those were his words. When we asked him in a later conversation if he plans to have this person who we were concerned about in a leading role, he said he would. He has made numerous statements, and you could check this, that he does want to reopen, but we're worried that the way in which he wants to reopen, he wants to probably make the Kyiv Post less independent, possibly make it more of a mouthpiece and less of a newspaper than it is right now.
So the negotiations that you were in with Mr. Kivan, are they dead in the water now?
No, they are not dead in the water. We're still negotiating. I am not at liberty to discuss where we are at in the negotiations, but we are definitely still negotiating.
What are you asking for from Adnan Kivan?
Well, we are asking for one of two things. We would like him to sell the Kyiv Post to a buyer we can both mutually agree on. And we do have interested buyers, several of them. We can't disclose their names yet because nothing's final, but we do have prospective buyers who are very interested in our brand and our independence. And if that's not possible for him, we would also consider the possibility where if he can somehow relinquish the trademark into the hands of an entity, possibly an NGO that's created by the Kyiv Post staff, that could also be a workable solution.
Hmm. Igor, who is the audience for the Kyiv Post?
Our audience consists of much of the Ukrainian diaspora living overseas, of course, or are living in it, foreigners, the diplomatic corps, international organizations, including international financial institutions, business associations in Ukraine, business people, investors, and form this kind of informational bridge between Ukraine and the West. And a lot of other publications look to our coverage when they're looking into Ukraine. A lot of people who want to be involved in Ukraine. So do many diplomats. I think that if we are gone, it's going to hurt not only media independence here, but I don't see anyone filling our niche.
Igor Kosov is the former news editor at the Kyiv Post, speaking with us about the newspaper getting shuttered by its owner this week. Igor joined us from Kyiv. Thank you very much. Good to speak with you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
We reached out to Adnan Kivan, the owner of the Kyiv Post, for comment. By airtime, we had not heard back. The conflict that started a year ago in northern Ethiopia has spread to other parts of the country. Rebels from the Tigray region have now even advanced toward Addis Ababa, the capital. Yesterday, the United Nations said at least 16 of its staff members were detained in Addis Ababa. There are reports from the city of widespread arrests of ethnic Tigrayans. Also, today, dozens of UN drivers were detained in another part of Ethiopia. To tell us about what it's like in Addis right now, Befeqadu Haylu is on the line. He's a journalist based there. We're really trying to get a sense of what the atmosphere is like in Addis right now, Befeqadu. Does it feel like Ethiopia is in the midst of a civil war there in the city proper?
Yes, of course. People always consume news that is about the war in the northern part of Ethiopia, so people are very much worried. In any case, people are also concerned about the deteriorating human rights situation. Tigrayans are being targeted because, you know, Ethiopia is ethnically demarcated federal state and in the Tigray region. They are experiencing ethnic profiling and targeted detention searches. And So the whole mood is disturbing. It could be the grand today, but tomorrow it could be everyone. So people see and know that.
We had been trouble reaching you today. Is it government blocking communications?
Yes, I mean, internet has been blocked, you know, in the war zone. It has been blocked for almost 1 year. But recently, all across the country, some applications, including Facebook, Telegram, messaging application, WhatsApp, are blocked from being accessible. But the excuse is pretty different. There is national exam for high school students, and it was said that the exam papers are leaked and students are exchanging them through messaging applications. So it is to prevent that exam leaking.
Ethnic Tigrayans do live in Addis. Does the city feel divided? Are people suspicious of one another right now?
It's not as exaggerated in some reports. I mean, there is no as cities that is as diverse as Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. So, of course, Tigrayans and others are also living here. But, of course, some people are worried about the TPLF's operation. Some people are worried about the government's reaction. And there are, of course, Tigrayans who might be supporting the TPLF, who might be also supporting the federal government. And, yeah, there are divided opinions, angry people, and so on. But still, the mainstream voice in Addis Ababa is supporting the federal government and opposing the TPLF.
So what do you expect the next few days and weeks will bring to Addis?
I don't know. I do not. I mean, there is a little opportunity that Olusegun Obasanjo started.
The special envoy, Olusegun Obasanjo.
Yeah, like he himself said it, you know, this window of opportunity is very short and we have little time. So everyone who is concerned about peace and reconciliation must push, you know, all warring parties so that they can sit and sort out their problems through, you know, any peaceful means rather than pushing all their supporters and citizens to war and endless fighting.
That was journalist Befeqadu Hailu in Addis Ababa, the Ethiopian capital, telling us what it's like there as a civil war in the north of the country increases tension throughout Ethiopia. When you're rushing out of the house, you know what essentials to grab, but what if you're leaving home and knowing you will probably never return? Then what do you take? That's a question thousands of Afghans faced as they fled their country when the Taliban took power at the end of the summer. For many, there was not much choice. It was whatever they could fit in a small bag. The world's Shirin Jafari brings us the stories of two Afghan women and their last-minute decisions.
As the news about the Taliban takeover reached the Afghan capital, 24-year-old Harir Hashem found herself in a panic.
A fear sank into my heart. I rushed very quickly with my father back to my home, and we just locked ourselves in our house and we were raiding.
Harir is a women's rights activist. She works for a non-profit organization called Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. She had never lived under Taliban rule, but she knew the group would not tolerate someone like her. In that moment, as fighters spilled into her city, Harir says she found it hard to make sense of what was happening.
Never have I ever imagined, even in my right mind, that this could happen so quickly and the way it did.
Around the same time and in the same city, Kabul, 20-year-old Tuba was having similar thoughts. She wondered what the Taliban would do if they found out she's an artist. It was such a difficult day, Tuba says. She asked that I not use her name because she fears for the safety of her relatives in Afghanistan. For many Afghans, August 15th, the day the Taliban took over the capital, is a day they'll never forget. It's when the life they knew ended and a new one began. Thousands were forced to leave out of fear, not knowing if they would ever be able to come back. And in those hectic days, inside each home, people like Tuba and Harir were making split-second decisions about what to leave behind and what to take with them. For Tuba, the artist, this was actually easy. She decided to take her two pets, a minor bird called Juji and her cat named Pishi. There was no way she was going to leave them behind, she says. There was no one to take care of them. They would die. So when it came time to go to the airport, Tuba gently put Pishi in her backpack. Juji, the bird, went inside a small cardboard box and she headed to the airport with her family. Over at Harir's place, there was also a last-minute scramble to pack.
I had to burn a lot of stuff, like my diplomas, everything, because there was, talks about Taliban going and searching people's houses. So I couldn't take those things with me. But I had my childhood pictures, I had my family's pictures, I had my grandma and grandpa's picture. And my grandpa's very dear to me. I've left him behind. And my grandma passed away, so...
Getting to the airport was a nightmare, both Harir and Tuba say. Just the thought of coming face-to-face with Taliban fighters made them shudder. These were the same people who targeted journalists, artists, and human rights workers. Even after getting through the Taliban checkpoints, they would still have to get inside the airport.
But video shows masses of people scrambling up a gangplank to get on board a plane.
Somebody pulled me and I fell and people were stomping on me. And then my father came and he rescued me. Otherwise, I would have been killed. The crowd was that manic and the crowd was that chaotic and everyone was just, scared.
Tuba says she couldn't get the cardboard box through the crowd. So she had to take the bird out and hold him in her hand. She worried the bird was going to suffocate, so she constantly checked to make sure he was breathing. Harir Hashem and her family tried multiple times to get on a plane out of Kabul. Each time they headed to the airport, she says, they brought even fewer of their belongings because it was hard to get them through the crowd. Time after time, they failed and had to go back home. On August 24th, they made their seventh attempt.
We reached some military personnel and we got their attention. And then when they saw us, they told us that the only way you can get through is to jump into the sewage. It smelled disgusting and we had to leave everything behind. The only thing I could bring with myself was my family and the pair of clothes that I had on and my passport.
Tuba was going through the same sewage canal to enter the airport. It was the only way in that wasn't blocked off. And she too had to leave behind almost everything, even Pishi, her cat, which she had to hand over to a stranger. But this was it for Tuba and Harir and so many others. After a harrowing experience, they were finally on the tarmac. Tuba's bird was still breathing. The first thing she did after stepping aboard the giant plane was to find some water to give him. Meanwhile, as Harir was getting close to the plane, she stopped and paused for a moment.
And right before reaching the plane, I saw the soil and I was like, I don't know if I'm going to be able to ever return or when am I going to return. So I took a bit of the soil and I had nothing. So I took out my mask and I put it in the mask and I covered it up and I kept it with myself.
Tuba and Harir say they never expected such a sudden, chaotic goodbye to their homeland. They say they're lucky to have been able to leave. So many Afghans never managed to get out. When Tuba's plane landed in the United Arab Emirates, her first stop, authorities confiscated Juji, the bird. They said she couldn't take him on the second leg of the trip to France. They told her to release the bird. Tuba pleaded with the officer. It turned out that the French ambassador, Xavier Châtel, was on the scene and he told Tuba that he could take care of the bird. So now Juji is with the French ambassador in the UAE and Tuba is in France. Tuba says the ambassador sends her videos of Juji, who has even learned to say hi in French. Harir is in Norway waiting for her immigration application to be processed.
This kind of going away was like a long-term goodbye and I was not ready for that.
Her first impression of her new home, Norway, it's so calm and serene, she says.
I hope that one day Afghanistan will have this kind of calm, this kind of peace, this kind of security, and where we all can return and hopefully serve our country the way it deserves.
In the meantime, she says she will treasure the fistful of soil she managed to take with her. For the world, I'm Shirin Jafori.
Afghan musician Koka Taban sings about what people took with them in a new song called A Small Bag. Taban wrote on Twitter, "We are now carrying our homes in our bags, bags that are brimming with sorrow and lost dreams, brimming with grief and suffering, bags that were too small to carry our Kabul or our grieving hearts." The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.